way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of a changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Today is May the 28th, 2026. This is episode 3,853 of the Survival Podcast. And it is time on a Thursday for an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. Now, normally, this would be where I would tell you, hey, guys, I'm going to be gone next week, and there would be nothing but rewinds next week, but we had a big announcement happen this week, didn't we? So even though, yes, I'm about to vanish for about 2 weeks into the mountains of Colorado with my family, I have one more show coming for you that will be new content before the rewinds begin next week. That will be on Monday when no less than Brad Thor, the author of 26 New York Times bestsellers. Let me say that again. 26 New York Times bestsellers. And this guy writes in kind of the same vein as like a Tom Clancy type thing. Really great author, really great subject, spellbinding books. Think of it like the American answer to James Bond in a way. I have been wanting to interview this guy for quite a few years. I've been talking to his publisher, and we've just never been able to make the stars align. And so even though my plan was to sign off today and say goodbye and see you next mid-month, we're going to have one more. So I just wanted to lead with that. Also want to let you know that I officially announced today the launch date for Laws of Life, Book 2, Now Build the System for Your Life, by me, myself, and I, Jack Spierko. That's correct. We have an email list to make sure you absolutely do not miss it. Even if you're on other lists, just get on it. Once or twice leading up to it, I will send you an email letting you know what's going on and remind you it's going to happen. Then the day that we release the book, I'll send you an email saying, it's alive, it's there, you can order it now. And then you can go order it. And after that, you know, then, you know, maybe pick up a couple extra copies for some friends and whatnot. If you thought Laws of Life Book 1 had some problems, you're right. But if you thought overall it was great, this is better. It's so much better that Laws of Life Book 1, second edition, is going to be dropping right around the same time. But I'm not sure exactly when that's going to come. Probably a couple weeks earlier. I'll let you know when that's here. But now Laws of Life 1 and 2 are going to be like this set that I'm really proud of. The improvement and what I was able to do with the second book was so dramatic, I actually went back to build the second edition of the first book, not just to fix the technical errors that were there. I'm not going to kick that dog anymore. He's dead. But when I got done with book two, I was so satisfied with my work that I was literally embarrassed by book one. And I don't mean the spellings and the typos. I mean the quality of the book overall. I went back, retrofitted in my new formulas that are in the second book, which are chapter distills and these framework filtering formulas that help you actually fully grasp, understand, and implement the law into your life, along with some other really cool components that were added to the second book. So I didn't just fix the problems. I went back and retrofitted all of that into the first book. And overall, I expanded the first book by over 25,000 words. So it is not just we changed a few things and updated the cover. It is a true, complete, viable second edition, so much so that I have no choice but to release it as a second edition. It would literally be like against terms of service and probably law for me to not call it a second edition. So that's coming out too. If you want to learn more about that, just go to survivalpodcast.com and you'll see a post there. It says Laws of Life 2 is dropping on June 30th. There's a form there. You fill that out. And here's how this form is going to work. You fill it out, you get a couple notices, then you get the day of, and probably we'll do like one more like Thursday or Friday that week, because we're dropping it on a Tuesday because everybody's kind of sleepy on a Monday, right? So I wanted to hit it with a big hit beginning of the week on a Tuesday. Maybe Friday we'll send an email that says, hey, if you haven't done so yet, please remember to go get a copy so we get it into that first week of sales. And then I'm going to delete that list. Figuring if you want to stay in touch with us about the books and everything, go to jackslaws.com. You can opt in over there or what have you for long term. This is only for the launch. So you won't be getting tons of emails. You won't get show updates or anything like that. If that's not your bag, I get it. This is just to get the book off the ground. And I want to tell you, if when you read the first book, you were like, this is really good, but man, the people that need to read this are like 15 to 30 year olds, right? Somewhere in that range, younger people. Oh my, you are going to feel that 100 times over in book two. Book two is so much deeper and so much more direct attacking the problems in life from an action standpoint. More stories, more just, you'll love it. I'll just put it to you that way. If you like this show, you're going to love this book. If you love this show, you're going to fall in love with Laws of Life Book 2. So make sure you're prepared to get your copy of it. Now, what the hell are... Jack, this is supposed to be expert counsel. What are we going to talk about today? You're on about Brad Thor and the book. Okay, all right, here. Ron Paul and Dan McAdams have a piece for us called The U.S. Should have voluntarily left the Middle East. Now we're being kicked out. I'm going to put this under the Dan McAdams doing George Bush Jr. Mission accomplished. I don't think they're right about this at all. And it is not about the ethics or the morality and should we, because I completely agree with we should not. And I totally agree that the U.S. should have voluntarily left the Middle East a long time ago. Right. But the conclusion drawn from what Iran is saying, I think there is a certain segment of our side of things, the liberty side of things, that so wants things to be true that they will commit the same errors that mainstream does in seeing a mission complete when it's not. Even if they don't like the results of it, it's still at least it was better than it was. No. I don't think that anything that Iran says right now should be taken seriously from a military standpoint. I'm sorry if you don't like that. I promise to always do one thing, right? Like I said earlier this week on my show Tuesday, I will always tell you the truth. That whether you want to hear it or not, I will always tell you the truth. At least the truth is I can understand it. Andy McCann will talk about the good, the bad, the ugly. In fact, just the bad and the ugly of GLP-1s for weight loss. I have an add-on for this one because I have a family member who literally had her body destroyed by this and is still not recovered. She also lost a lot of weight. But not directly because of the GLP-1, because of the massive, horrific side effects that continue long after she stopped using it. So I'll reinforce what Andy has to say with that. Carrie Brown will talk about making comfrey salve, and what is the difference in making comfrey salve just from leaves, or you know, using leaf and root together, or just from root, and does the medicine that we make from the roots have more efficacy and better results than if we just use leaf? That's a good one. Joel Ross will talk about dealing with something I know a lot about, a high energy dog, right? Malinois and Malcry. I have a Malinois Shepherd cross, actually, though. If you look at her, she looks all Mally. I put them into, like, this is their growth phase. Month 1 to 3, they're cute little puppies. From about month 3-ish to 4-ish, they turn into a velociraptor. They are then a velociraptor until about 2 years of age, when they turn into like your average everyday high energy dog that needs a lot of attention. And almost to the second of their third birthday, if you train them well, they turn into the most calm, level-headed dogs you'll ever own. It's a weird thing. But you don't have to deal with the velociraptor in high energy stage with it all being a problem. You can train behavior even in that stage, and exercise alone is not the answer. That's the subject of Joel's talk today. Then Doc Bones will talk to us about the dreaded hantavirus, or hantavirus, depending on which retard on TV is talking about it. Now, you notice that he was a little bit late with this one. And it's not my fault, Bones. Like, I just got this week, right? It's already ebbed out. We don't really hear much about it anymore. It's gone back to drift off in another Neverland. But you actually heard about hantavirus quite recently, but before this. And somebody actually did die in the United States from it. And you won't even realize it until he says, you'll be like, oh, yeah, this is a bullshit fear tactic that the media ran. what got me, though, is a lot of people thought it's like COVID 2.0, they're going to lock us down and shit. No, that was never going to happen, which I said. But I still think there's people out there concerned about this. And this is actually an illness. Specifically, the variety of it that we get in the New World, North and South America both, is actually, if you get it, incredibly deadly. Even with treatment, it can be quite deadly, and without treatment, at least early on, like tuberculosis advanced stages, it is incredibly deadly, even with the best treatment they can find. There is risk from it, and for 99.9% of you, you will never even encounter the risk, let alone the illness. However, there are places in the country where it is a legitimate risk, just like there are places in the country where bubonic plague is a legitimate risk. The reality today, though, is that it is actually easier to treat bubonic plague, once diagnosed, than hantavirus. So it's not nothing, but it's mostly nothing. Does that make sense? If it doesn't, I bet you Doc Bones will make it make sense. Now, what is true cold storage for your Bitcoin? And does a Start 9 play any role in that at all? Or does a Start 9 even need to play a role? Or can it, but it's not needed? How does this all work? We will hear about that from, you guessed it, Jesse Markowitz. And then I am going to talk to you about why people are waking up to the fraud of college degrees versus the bullshit story the media is now running with. I just so happened to share this morning on my social media accounts some screenshots from my Fox News, and I should start calling Fox News Fox, like F-A-U-X, F-U-A-X, however you say, like that means fake, okay? And, but this part is real. They always have real, but then the talking heads start talking and it all goes shit. So the first screenshot I shared said, Fox Bowl, faith in higher education falls. And then there's a question for people, and this is between now and June 2006, the differential. The statement was, a college degree is key to success and should be obtained at any cost. Well, back in 73% of people were complete morons and agreed with that, that you should acquire a college degree at any cost. It doesn't matter what you have to give up, what you have to do. You have to cut a frickin' hand off, you get your college degree. 73% said that. 49% said no, okay, in June 2006. Now, 27% of people agree with that. 27% agree with that, and 73% disagree. So the way they have this laid out is a little bit confusing. In 2006, 46% agreed at any cost, so it wasn't as retarded as it sounded. But that number's dropped to 27, and today 73% disagree with that. Then the third screenshot they put up, advice to a high school student if they already had $100,000. This is really a rigged question, because borrowing $100,000 is actually worse than spending $100,000 if you're borrowing it against something without a resale value. You understand that? Like, if I borrow $100,000 to buy a house, I can only sell the house. If I borrow $100,000 to get a college degree and it doesn't work out, I can't sell the degree to somebody else. See how that works? Okay. But if you did have $100,000 in 2006, okay, then use for college, 65% of people said that that person in 2006 with $100,000 in cold hard cash in their hand, instead of doing anything else with, like, start a business, go to trade school, just go to work and invest it in their future in a 401k, whatever, 65% they should spend all their money and go to college, invest and go to work. 21% said that. Today, 33% say you should spend the $100,000 on college, and 65% say go to work. When I shared those screenshots, I said, no one could have possibly told you like 10 or 15 years ago that this was going to happen, could they? Oh, that's right, it was me. And now what is the excuse making that the right, who also thinks college is great, especially when they sit in vaulted ceilings and shit like that up in their corporate offices, what is their excuse? It's AI. Okay, sure, it's AI. Sure. I saw it 15 years ago, but it's AI now. Okay, they also say that the other problem is all the liberal lunacy at colleges. Well, that can't help matters. I'll give you that. But that's not why. If a degree had the value that they've told you it's had for the last 40 years as they've devalued it with their bullshit, people would tolerate and say, yeah, you know, I'm going to send Billy there and explain to him that there's a bunch of liberal retard shit there, and I'm going to try to keep Billy on track, but hey, he needs a degree. The degree doesn't have the fucking value. That's the problem. I'm going to talk more about that today in my anchor segment. With that, let's go ahead and drop on in and hear from Dan McAdams and Ron Paul. And are they hanging up the mission accomplished banner on the behalf of the Iranian government a little too soon? I will tell you what I think after we hear from them.
This is a kind of a wake-up call. Now, it's presented that you use the word victory. That's a good word to use because it's presented by the new Ayatollah Mujtaba Khamenei as a victory of Iran over the U.S., over U.S. aggression. And that's fine. I mean, they have their day in the sun. They had their victory. The fact that the U.S. bases in the region are no longer inhabitable. They will no longer be a safe haven, as he pointed it out. But we, for different reasons, can also claim a victory. Because for us, it's not that we wanted Iran to win. We didn't want them to be invaded in the first place. But for us, it's a victory because it shows that the U.S. cannot and should not maintain its military empire overseas, something you've been arguing against for decades. It shows that it's not sustainable. Click on that first. So that, I would say, it's a silver lining. So Iran's supreme leader says region will no longer be a safe haven for U.S. military bases. Go to the next one. And here's what he said. What is certain in this regard is that the hands of time will not turn back, and the nations and lands of the region will no longer serve as shields for U.S. bases. The United States will not only no longer have a safe haven for its mischief and for establishing military bases in the region, but day by day it is growing more distant from its former status. And I think he's right when he talks about this is an empire in decline. And the unsustainability of U.S. bases in the Middle East, I think, is a key indicator of this fact. You know, we've talked about it on the show before, but in 1956, in the Suez Crisis, it demonstrated to a bewildered British Empire that they're no longer the top dog. You know, they no longer have the power. It was a wake-up call for them. We can't sustain this empire that we have. You know, it exists still in our mind, but in reality, it doesn't exist. Because when we were told we can't do this, we looked around and realized we really can't do it. And I think that's where we are.
Well, usually the end of an empire comes with a difficulty in paying the bills and running up too much deficit. But getting away with it for longer than they deserve because, you know, we've been, you know, on the edge for a long time, and there's been predictions for many, many years and decades that you can't sustain this. And then when the interest on the payment of borrowing the money to maintain the empire finally gets bigger than what you're spending, that's trouble. And that's where we are right now.
What has happened now with this war of choice that the U.S., that President Trump launched against Iran, is that the deterrent is gone. The post-World War II arrangement in the Middle East was that you let us have bases here, and we will protect you from any threat. And that went along fine. The dollar was the global currency. Everything was rolling around. Oil was going everywhere that it needed to go. But then all of a sudden, the system was challenged. Just like in 1989, the system was challenged. The communist system was challenged. The U.S. strength in the Middle East was challenged as Iran responded to the U.S. Aggression, and it turns out that these bases were not providing the protection that was given. So the product was sold as something, and when it was tested, it didn't live up to the claims. Well,
so I'm going to say Dr. Paul, as usual, is hitting on it perfectly. He's opposed to this war like I am. But he's put his finger on the actual problem with the empire. It's not a war in the strait with Iran. This is a rounding error in the total amount of money that we've pissed away, and the total amount of money that we now owe on the national debt of $38 trillion, but it's the $1 trillion a year in interest payments that's really the killer here. And I do think the end of empire is eventually coming. I've done shows on it, and I agree with that. But, you know, there's something else that Dr. Paul said here that's a little bit, you know, again, the mission accomplished banner going up too soon type of thing. It's been predicted for decades. Yes, it has. And if you told somebody 3 decades ago, look, by the year 2026, we'll have gone through all this stupid shit with a scamdemic, we'll have pissed away all this extra money, we've accelerated inflation, the national debt will stand at $38 trillion, and we will be paying over $1 trillion in interest alone. We will pay more in interest payments than our budget for, you know, Social Security and our budget for national defense. And then when that happens, they'll 1.5 multiply the national defense budget. So we're again spending more on national defense than the interest payments. What do you think the state of the United States economy will be? They would have said, well, the stock market's going to be, you know, like the S&P 500 is going to be at like 500. Unemployment will probably be at 30%. The country will be on the edge of total collapse. There'll be anarchy in the streets. Buildings will be burning, right? Congress clowns will be hanging from light posts. It'll turn into the third world. It'll be patriots to come and collapse, something like that, right? And what has happened? The markets continue to soar. Now, I think this is bad because the higher you go, the harder you fall, that type of thing. And that's going to come eventually on the other side of this at some point. But it's not gone, is it? See, I think this demise of the U.S. empire, we're celebrating it way too early. Remember that the fall of Rome took 300 years, and the Romans had nowhere near the tools of manipulation or the military power and force that we have today, not to mention a blue water navy that can destroy half the damn planet. And we'll use it, too. We just won't use it to destroy half the planet. And other people know we'll use it. So this can go on a lot longer. As for Dan's discussion with what the Iranian said, it's interesting he caught himself there. He caught himself when he said there, the bases have been made inhabitable, and then he just switched over. That's because earlier this year, Dan said that when a report came out that several FOBs, which are forward operating bases, which were basically like 1-acre little shit command centers, that we abandoned when the air war started because you can't defend everything, and we didn't really give a shit about them, were hit with some rockets and missiles, and we already knew that was going to happen before we left. That was a nonsensical thing that the mainstream media was trying to use, like, look, Iran is really winning. And then every time he talks about quotes from what the Iranians say, all I hear is fucking Baghdad Bob. Remember Baghdad Bob? Baghdad Bob, do you remember? When the U.S. invaded Iran? There are no Americans here. Right, and there's literally tanks like behind him in the streets, like that. These guys have threatened so much, and they have so little that they can actually do. Militarily, force on force, they've got nothing. They can hit something here and there. We can hit everything we want whenever we want. You know, I said Putin was using restraint in Ukraine, and you got mad at me. Trump's using restraint in Iran. Oh, and probably more than he should. You want to cut off supplies while you negotiate? Do you know where Iran's getting most of this? Now, I'm not saying we should do this. I don't want us to do this at all. I'm talking about if you're going to have a war, then you prosecute the fucking war. So the first thing I would do if you said, well, how do we cut off their supplies? Well, there's a railroad that brings shit tons of stuff into Iran, and I don't want to kill civilians or anything. But last I checked, trains can't turn off the tracks, and they need the tracks, so I would just blow the fucking tracks up for like 3 miles inside of Iran, and then I would say Space Force is monitoring the location, and if we see you unload, then we're going to explode. See what I'm saying? And then I would cut that off, and every place there was a choke point like that, I would cut that off, and I would make it even harder for them. We're not doing even that, let alone blowing up all the bridges and power plants. Power plants? You want to shut off the power? You don't have to blow up the power plant. How does the power get where it's going? Across transmission lines and through substations. You could shut off power all over Iran right now without actually blowing up the main power generation facilities that would take decades or longer to repair and put more pressure. There's a lot of things you could do. You don't have to take out all the bridges. You could take out a couple key bridges and one at a time. Like, hey, Ahmed, cut your shit. No? Boom. Okay. Now, tomorrow I'm going to take out. Boom. Oh, shit. That one went early. Call you back tomorrow, man. Let you know what's happening next. Click. Again, I don't want to do this. I'm saying if you want to win a war, that's how you fucking win a war. we're dicking around. Who knows how long this can go on? This can go on a lot longer than you think. What do you think Trump's doing right now by not bombing the shit out of stuff? He can only go use force for so long without a pause before he can do it again without going to Congress for approval. That's why there's a pause right now. That's what's defensive action only, which, by the way, that is actually not a lie. Of all the lies, that was the truth. Like, when somebody blows your shit up and you blow it back, that's a defensive action, okay? Right? When Iran says, yes, we have ceasefire, and then they, the next day, in the middle of ceasefire talks, are using their hovercraft to plant mines in the strait while they said they're, not doing it, and then they cry because, you know, some Apaches went in and waxed their ass, I don't care. I'm sorry. Like, that was dumb. Right? And the poor guys on those boats had to be like, they aren't really going to make us do this, are they? Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I think that we're seeing the end before it's here. That's a mission accomplished banner from Dan, and I like Dan, but you're just wrong, bro. Let's move on and talk about something a little more interesting as far as I'm concerned. GLP-1s. Let's hear from Andy McCann on his thoughts on GLP-1s.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own a CrossFit garage. I have been doing CrossFit for almost 20 years. Do you need to do it? No. It is just the biggest hack to health and fitness that I have ever found. If you need help finding a gym, let me know, and I will do what I can to find the crossroads where you're at and find something that makes sense to you. But the question today was, Andy, what about GLP-1s? What do you stand on that? Here's my easy answer. I'm not a doctor, and I don't know where you're at. Everything, it really, as Jack says, it depends. So if you're like 400 pounds and you're about to go into knee surgery and you need to lose a lot of weight, man, this might be a great option to lose that weight. Maybe liposuction too, right? There's extreme cases where almost anything matters. Now, if you're an average person and I just want to lose weight, then here's the thing. I would try everything else. And if you're willing to stab yourself with some drugs, did you hire an expert? If you haven't hired somebody to help you, that's just foolish. If you hire a mentor, it'll increase the speed of acquisition of whatever the skill or thing is that you want by a massive amount. So I have people that I know, like, and trust. Coach Josiah, Coach Matt, Coach Jennifer, that work here with me, and they do all this stuff remotely. So if you need somebody and you're like, I don't know who to trust, trust me that trusts them and extend that trust over to them, right? So I guess, you know, it's the circle of trust. You've trusted Jack, and Jack trusts me, and so therefore we can trust one of my guys because I know, like, and trust them. Anyway, they're going to speed you up. So typically I am going to tell you, no, don't do anything medical until you've exhausted everything else. Yes, I get it. Sometimes you need to do the medical thing. Yeah, I'm not saying in those cases. I'm just saying you were David Desk Jockey and you wake up one day and you're like, well, damn, I'm fat. I should probably do something about it. How about I stab myself in the stomach with a needle? I don't know. That just sounds bad. How about instead we look at what you're doing and what you're eating and go down that road of let's edit the crap food that you're, well, it's not even food. Most of the stuff you eat is entertainment. So let's edit the entertainment and see if we can get that right first. For example, at my gym, I tell people all the time, if you track your food for 2 weeks, I will help you for free for 1 hour. So my buddy Alan, he tracked his food in Excel, which is fine, but he didn't weigh it. So I'm like, look, you didn't do the hard part, which is weigh and measure. So I'm just going to give you a quick glance and then a better glance and then a last glance. But I'm not going to spend an hour on this because you didn't actually do what I asked. But just, yes, track and measure, but also weigh it, right? Anyway, so he sent me it. I looked at it. It's like, well, right here, I see every night you have a glass of wine. The easy one for me is the first pass is like, just remove the glass of wine and you'll be good. Then he said, but Andy, my wife likes to drink a glass of wine at night, and she wants me to unwind with her, so she wants me to drink a glass of wine too. I was like, okay, totally different problem. It really depends what you're trying to solve. Are you solving for your fatness, or are you solving for your relationship? So what I would say in that instance is, honey, could I drink something that is wine-like? I don't know, just get some water and then put some food coloring in it? I don't know. Just see if that would work. So she probably doesn't care what you are drinking unless there's a whole guilt issue of I drink wine every night and I need you to be guilty with me. That's totally different. You need marriage counseling and life counseling. I actually have somebody that will help you with that. Coach Jamie is a therapist. So if you need that, I have people. But that's a whole different route. That is not something that I deal with. The easy part, though, was get rid of the wine. He said no. I was like, all right, well, let's look at the other things. I said, it looks like you're hitting a lot of your protein goals, except it's not meat-based. are you okay with eating more red meat or just meat in general? And he's like, well, no. I'm like, okay, so the advice I was going to give you, you're not interested in. And these are part of the problems. Like, I'm not hitting the goals I want. I'm like, yeah, I mean, peanut butter as a protein source isn't as good as steak. So there's that. Okay, so GLP-1s. I'm probably always going to tell you, but what else first? And if you haven't hired somebody, then I would wait. But I know people who use them and they've got the confidence boost and it was the necessary thing to get them over the hump, to get them to the place. I would just start a little bit smarter. So I think typically, maybe they've changed this recently, the shot just does a thing. So there's like one unit of dosing and you just jam it in you and you're done. I would make it a smaller dose if you can and build up or down based on what you need. So start off super small. Does it hit what you need? And then is there a way to get off of it? If the doctor says, oh, you'll just be using this forever, I don't know. I'm not a big fan of it. I'm 52. I don't take any drugs. I have I don't even really have a primary doctor. Is it the food I eat? Is it the movement I do? I don't know. Is it the uncanniness? Like in the movie Unbreakable, there was Samuel L. Jackson, which was totally breakable. He was Glass Man. But then there was... oh man, yippee-ki-yay, I can't think of his name, Bruce Willis. So it was Bruce Willis who couldn't be hurt, right? So am I that person? I don't think so, because I have a ringing in my ear right now. So I get sick and I get in trouble, so I'm not that guy. But I get it, there are some genetics out there that are predisposed to something, right? What our mothers do while they're pregnant does affect what genes are turned off and on. Okay, so GLP-1s. Man, that's a tough one. If you have questions, I would happily help you individually because I think that's a better way to go. Y'all take care. Again, you can find my podcasts at Fitness, Food, and Finance. You can find me at CrossFitGarage.com. You can email me, Andy@CrossFitGarage.com, or on YouTube, at AndyMcCann42. Y'all take care.
I'm going to say, I think people could go a long way if you don't want to take kind of the carnivore approach Andy does or the more like keto type of approach that I do. Or occasionally, you know, if I'm going to eat bread or whatever, I'll eat like sourdough or something like that. And real sourdough, not the bullshit from the store that just says sourdough because they put some souring shit in it to make it taste like sourdough. Made from, you know, wheat, right? Water and freaking yeast culture, sourdough yeast culture. That's what goes in bread. That's all you need. If you just basically did that part, like stop eating things in a box, stop eating things with multisyllabic words that you can't pronounce or understand. Don't eat anything with high fructose corn syrup in it, etc. That alone would solve most of these problems. I keep going back in my head to being a kid in the 70s and 80s, and like there was, like I always say this, there was one fat kid in our high school. One. In the whole school. Four grades. I'm not talking about just my class. His name was Jason. Sorry, Jason, you were fat. Really fat. But there was one. And if you said the fat kid, people were like, it's so and so. I had a conversation with my wife one time and I said this, and she immediately popped out a name. Right? Today, you wouldn't know who we're talking about. There's fat kids everywhere, and there's fat adults everywhere. We have type 2 diabetes and an epidemic level in our kids. But if you go back to the 1970s, even early 80s, people ate the hell out of carbs. I grew up Ukrainian. There was pierogies on the table 3 days a week sometimes a year. My grandmother made bread on a constant basis. She made bread like a peasant in the 1600s. We had... if it was a potato, could go in something, a potato went in the thing. And yet, you know, fat didn't mean what it even means today. When you said somebody was fat, you meant they were carrying like 10 to 15 extra pounds. That's what you meant. So there is something to what people are eating. On the GLP-1 side alone, though, this is my sister-in-law's experience. She was a tad high on her A1C, not type 2 diabetic, right? A little bit overweight. I'm talking like 10 pounds, maybe 15 pounds over ideal weight. She went on GLP-1. She's incredibly thin now, and she doesn't look great. I don't mean to be insulting to her or anything. I mean that when you look at her face, you can see stress lines. That's what I mean. Now, she just retired, so maybe that'll help a little bit. But this is a direct result of what the GLP-1s did to her. And the way she lost so much weight is basically she's pretty much carnivore now. Well, how'd that work? Well, after two doses, she gets violently ill when she eats almost all carbohydrates. Explain that. Ironically, if she wants bread, if she eats real sourdough, she can eat some of that without a problem. There might be a linkage there, but let me explain to you the basics of what a GLP-1 does. It slows down your digestive process. It makes food take longer to get through. As you absorb the food less quickly, you feel more full, and you expel more that you never observe. In other words, you shit some of your food out without actually processing it. And this is actually a natural thing the body produces. Your body makes GLP-1. And so what they say is, well, how could it be bad if your body produces it? Yeah, you know what? Go take like a giant horse syringe, fill it up with insulin and stick that in your arm and see what the fuck. Don't do it. You'll die really quick. Right? Think of how many different things your body produces that if they're produced in excess, they will fuck you up or literally kill you. GLP-1 is one of those things. You can certainly take too much of it. Yeah? So the problem is, for some people, that will hit them spot on early. And for some people, it might hit them somewhere later on. And you don't know when. So even the people that say, well, I'm taking it, it's fine. You know, here's a story that makes me think of. My uncle had a friend named, what the hell was his name now? Prater Great or something like that. Greg. Let's just call him Greg. And he had these big-ass Mickey Mouse boots, like from Vietnam or Korea or some shit that were supposed to keep your feet warm. I guess it was Korea. And they literally had a valve on them, and you blew them up with an air pump. And they looked ridiculous, but it was supposed to be that the air acted as an insulator for your feet and kept your feet warm. So I see these boots, and I asked my uncle about them. He said, they don't work. I said, well, he said they do. He said, if you bought them with your money and put them on your feet and some kid asked you about them and you look like a moron like he does, what would you say? I'm like, oh, okay, I get it. I think a lot of people say it works. They did lose some weight. They do have some side effects. They're really willing to deal with the side effects. They don't want to admit it. Because this is another thing I've noticed, and this includes like celebrities that advertise this shit. You see a commercial with them. Charles Barkley is an example. They don't look right. I'm sorry. Yes, they're thinner. They don't look right. There looks like something's wrong, and I'll tell you what that wrong is. Nutrient deficiency. They're aggravating what we already are, which is nutrient deficient. I do not recommend them unless, like, you are going to die if you don't lose weight. And then still understand the risk you're taking. Let's move on and talk about Comfrey with Kerry Brown.
Hey, TSP community. Kerry here from Strong Roots Resources. And Tom wrote in asking about basically the differences in strength and lasting effect of Comfrey root versus Comfrey leaf when it comes to making medicine. So he wrote in and said that a distant relative relayed to me that he far exceeded a doctor's expectations for healing from a ladder fall by using a comfrey root salve or ointment. Some sources seem to confirm that the root is far more effective in getting into the deep tissues or joints than just the leaves. I'd like to make a preparation for my mother who is dealing with joint pain. I found recipes that tincture the dried root in alcohol first, and another that infuses the root in oil. Can you give any advice on which might be better at extracting the healing compounds? And if so, do I have a proven recipe or method for a root preparation? And I do, and it's pretty lengthy, so what I'm going to do is copy that exactly in my email to Jack so he can throw that in the show notes. But for the recorded segment here, it is true that there is a greater concentration of the alkaloids that help comfrey deliver those healing constituents. There's a greater concentration of those in the root when extracted through an alcohol tincture. And there is some further evidence that the two-stage method, basically what he was asking about, can kind of get you the most healing properties going on. But what I do want to caution is I do not think I would personally take internally a comfrey root tincture. I would stick with like a very strong tincture, an alcohol tincture that is then, you know, you take your dropper and you drop some drops into a salve or some kind of carrying agent, some kind of skin-safe oil of the sort, And I would imagine, and in the research I've gotten into so far, that should convey some really deep healing properties. The reasoning behind going to get external use, there is some evidence, and it may be overblown, but this is one of those things I'm not going to take a chance on. There is some evidence that it can be pretty hard on your liver. And so if you are already, if your liver is already overworked, shall we say, for any number of reasons, personally, I would not take it internally. Now, as a little aside here, that I was just listening to one of Jeff Lawton's podcast panels, Permaculture, Discover Permaculture, and he was talking about eating comfrey leaf. He was talking about different ways of preparing it. He likes to put it into a smoothie and different ways that he gets that hairy and fuzzy texture. So, you know, who knows? I mean, it doesn't strike me as something that I would personally want to consume. I would like to keep it as a as an external healing agent. So let me get into just a few details here for you guys. The alcohol tincture extracts a broader range of compounds, especially the alkaloids. Oil infusion is gentler and it works well for the salves, but oil alone is not the best solvent for all of comfrey's medicinal constituents. And because of that, a lot of experienced herbalists use a dual approach. They make a strong alcohol extract first, and then they incorporate that into a salve or a lotion. For something that is practical and stable and effective for joint or nerve pain, personally, I would try a low heat infused oil made from a dried root, and then turn that into a salve. And while we're talking about the roots, as it is with most things foraging, most of the useful properties of a plant are located in the area of the plant that is most active at that time of year. In other words, obviously the leaves are active through the growing season. So if you're going for the healing compounds in the root, you want to dig those roots out anywhere from late fall when the leaves have died back up to very early spring before it's really started to leaf out again. That's when that's going to be most concentrated. So I think the rest of my notes here will actually work better if I just send this as a text that you guys can pull up in the show notes and follow the recipe and everything. But a few little add-ons here while you're pulling your comfrey together and you want to value add your medicine. Arnica is a great one to add, St. John's wort infused oil, ginger root, cayenne in very small amounts, and keep that stuff away from your mucous membranes, and essential oils like peppermint or lavender, and those are things that will kind of really aid, you know, you've kind of got yourself like a super healing salve going on there. And when you're making your infusions, this is a slow process. This is a low heat process. This is one of those things that you definitely want to not be in a rush when you are preparing it. I have also written and forwarded Tom's question to one of the herbalists in my own network here and kind of in the LFTN network. And when I hear back from her, I am also going to pass along further info. But I wanted to get out something to you before too long, and be on the lookout for more specifics as soon as I get it all pulled together. Thank you so much for the question, Tom. I'm glad to help out, and I appreciate that you're enjoying our segments, and we will talk to you guys next time.
So personally, on the internal use thing, I do have a slight disagreement there. I wouldn't even worry about it, and I'll tell you why. Because I did the research into the research that resulted in the recommendation and the ban of comfrey for internal use. And the rats that were fed the comfrey that experienced liver damage, and in some cases serious chronic liver damage, were taking the equivalent over 6 months as if a human had eaten 60,000 leaves. So Yeah, maybe you don't be needing no Confreak tinctures or anything like that, but I wouldn't worry about it is kind of what I'm saying. I think the entire thing is completely overblown. Excess Confreak can indeed cause liver damage, though. That is true. So how much is, you know, the poisons in the dose type of thing? But I think in most instances, there's no real need or even major advantages to internal Confreak. So it's not that I think that it's dangerous. I think that it's got a little bit of risk and not much to gain. Now, on a topical use, I will just say, like, if you don't want to use root and you just want to get a stronger salve, the main way we do this is we take leaves and we put them in something like olive oil or tallow works as well. Pig lard works really good because your skin is really big on absorbing pig lard because it's so close to your own fat. And then we use heat and thyme to extract from those leaves. Nothing would stop you from, once you've done a single extraction, removing the leaves, leaving behind the oil, and throwing a whole other vat of leaves in there. I do think, and there is plenty of evidence, even more than Carrie said, that there are stronger acting components in the root that can be seen with, like, spectral analysis and things like that. So it is absolutely a great practice, and I have found Confreak to be one of the most effective and safest things that we can use and make our own medicine with at home. I would say, like, my big three are garlic. Actually, I got four. You got garlic, you got Confreak, you got dandelion, and you got elderberry. Those are like the four that we most rely on ourselves for things at home. Moving on, let's talk about, well, I put Crazy Dog in the name of the file. That's not true, is it, Belle? She's with me today because I got guys working in my office. It is High Energy Dogs and dealing with High Energy Dogs.
Hello, everyone. This is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you again with another Expert Counsel segment. Okay, today's question comes from Mike. Mike has a high energy dog, and he's trying to exercise it every day to get it to be more calm and more obedient, and it's just not working. So Mike's asking me, how much exercise do these dogs need to wear them out and make them obedient? The real answer is, exercise is not your problem. Now, don't get me wrong, your dog should get some level of exercise regularly, but your dog should not need exercise to be obedient. If your dog isn't being obedient all the time, the problem is not the dog, it's the handler. Just trying to make your dog tired really shows a lack of discipline in both you and your dog. The dog hasn't been trained to obey even when it doesn't feel like it, and the handler is almost certainly being inconsistent in the way that they're handling and training their dog. One of the biggest mistakes people make is they separate exercising their dog from training their dog. I always recommend these two things be combined together. So don't go throw the ball with your dog and just let it run around and do whatever it wants. What you're doing is creating bad habits in your dogs, and your excuse is, but they need exercise. All that does is reinforce chaos. Instead, everything you do with your dog should be some level of obedience. So if I go running with my dog should be at my side in a foos, even though I'm running. If I go for a walk or a hike, my dog should be at my side in obedience while I'm doing those things. If I'm playing fetch with the dog shouldn't just do whatever it wants. It should go get the item that I threw for it, pick it up, bring it back to me, let go of it when I tell them to, and then return to obedience. I'll tell the dog, go get it, and they'll run out and they'll pick it up. I tell them, good, get it, bring it back. They should bring it back to me. They come up in front of me, I put my hands on the ball or the frisbee or whatever it is you want to throw, and I say, out. When they let go, I go, good, out, and then I reset the exercise again. Now you've turned fun and exercise into training. The dogs love this stuff, and you're reinforcing your training throughout the whole process. Even when my dog is free, they're still under obedience. I tell them they're free, but then if I call them back to me at any point while they're running around and checking things out, they should break off free and return back to me immediately. If your dog will not return to you once you set them free in the yard or something like that, then they don't deserve that level of freedom. When my dog does come back to me, I give them lots of praise and I let them know they're doing a good job. We go to the next step, whether I want them to walk at my side, sit, wait, whatever it is I want them to do, and we move on with our lives. A lot of times when I'm letting my dog run free, I'll call him back to me, I'll praise him up, and then I'll just go, you're free again. just to reinforce, you come back to me. Anytime you come back to me, I'm going to give you love as long as I have the time and opportunity. Something serious is not going on. And then sometimes I'm just going to let you go back out and run around again. When you train this way, something really important happens. Your dog learns that they're always to be in tune with your voice. They're always to listen to your commands, and they're always to do what they're told, even if they're distracted and doing something else. Most high-energy dogs, like Belgian Malinois, Dutch Shepherds, and German Shepherds, don't need a ton of exercise. They just need discipline. They need structure, they need to learn to be still, and they need to learn that they're always to obey commands when they're given. When this is done correctly, your dog will always respond to your commands, even if they're in the middle of playing. You can give your dog freedom, but they have to act appropriately even when they're free. Don't run to the trash cans and get into the trash. Don't jump up on people. Don't run into other people's yards when you're not supposed to. If you don't have the level of control that can give a command to your dog and they'll stop doing any of those behaviors, they probably haven't earned the freedom to be free yet. If they haven't earned the freedom yet, don't give it to them. Continue to be disciplined, require obedience, give your corrections as needed, and then once they've established a good pattern there, you can start to give them freedom. Don't give too much freedom and always require them to return out of that immediately back to you whenever you give a command. If you start having issues with this, you're probably giving too much freedom to your dog. Remember, freedom is something that the dog needs to earn. So I hope this was helpful for you. If you'd like more information learning how to train your own dog, check out Canine Academy by going to thesurvivalpodcast.com and clicking on the Canine Academy banner and check out the courses that we have there available. And if you're looking for a working line puppy or a fully trained companion or protection dog, check out fortresscanine.com, click on the consult button, send us a message, and I'll reach out to you. Until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
You know, I completely agree with Joel on everything on this. I have no corrections or, you know, even other angles to look at. I do have some other things you might start doing to help yourself with dog training. So, like, one of the most important commands I think you can teach a dog is wait. Wait means exactly what it sounds like. It's basically stay, right? You stay here the way I have you until I tell you to move. And you can make this part of your daily training without actually making it training. Like Joel was saying, require obedience all the time. So here's an example. Belle loves to go in the truck. And she loves to get her little service dog coat on because she knows if she puts the coat on, the vest on, that she's going. And she gets her special necklace and her we call it her magic rope or leash. And once that all comes out, she is ready to go. She is in full-on Maloraptor mode, right? Maligator mode. And so she runs outside. She's barking. She's all happy. I don't care. She can celebrate. When I go to get in the truck, what I do is I put the seats up so I don't get dog hair all over the seats, and I put her dog bed in the back of the truck for her to lay on. And when I'm doing that, you know what she's doing? She's sitting, watching me do it, patiently waiting while I do it. And in every place that I get the opportunity to make that dog wait, I do. And I praise her for it, so she likes doing it. What I mean is if I take her out, like I go out and I'm like, come with me, right? And we go out and we walk around, we get back to the house, she's excited to go in the house. So I have her sit in front of the door, I tell her to wait, and I say it one time. And if she moves, I use Joel's immediate correction, right? Wait, she waits, she's looking at me now, you don't have to wait now. wait, and I walk in the door. I will walk 10, 15 feet into the house. I'll stand there and scratch my ear. I'll look around. I'll come back to the door and I'll say, you can come in now. Or I'll say, break. That's her command. But I try to get my dogs where they can understand sentences and shit. So they can come in now. She'll come in. And every place I go, I'll use that command. She loves to get pet sitting up on her bed because she's high up at your face level. So she'll go in our master bedroom. I'll tell her to get up on the bed for pets. I'll say, go to your pet spot. She'll go up there to get pets. I'll pet her and I'll tell her, wait. And I will go sit on the couch for 5 minutes. And if she comes out, I will physically put her back in that spot and say, wait. And then I'll sit on the couch for 10 minutes. The alarm goes off. I'll say, here, Belle. And she'll come to me. She's coming to me now. Come on, baby. You're a good girl. And then you know, I'll have her sit next to me on the couch for a little bit. And just doing little things like that. See, now what you're doing is kind of what he was alluding to. You're engaging the canine brain. You have to engage not just the physical component for the dog, but the mental component for the dog as well. And sitting and waiting and paying attention, or I'll put her in our window and I'll tell her to watch and wait. So she's looking out our big picture window at our front yard. She's watching for the evil Amazon guy, for the contractors working on my office, for anybody that needs to die because they dare come to our house. And when somebody shows up, I'll say, she'll like that. Okay, good. I see him. Okay, he's okay. He's all right. Good alert. I will praise the alert, but I will correct barking and making a bunch of noise after I've acknowledged it and told her it's okay. You just take little things like this. Never, like, you know, these ABCs. How about ABTs? Always be training, right? Always be training. Just come up with little games to play with your dogs throughout the day, giving them something they have to do. It doesn't always have to be chasing a Frisbee. Though that's good. I think the physical activity, like Joel says, great. Just you don't only need that. And here's the thing. If you have an 18-month-old working line dog, good luck wearing it out. You're not going to, it might be tired for like 5 minutes. You will never wear that dog fully out. That dog will need, especially at that age, 5 to 10 minutes of recovery time. And they'll be, if they were at a 9.9 when you worked them out and you worked them out and you get them down to a 5, in 10 minutes, they're a 9.8. Especially at that age. And those of you that have like Malinois, working line shepherds, et cetera, I'm telling you, there is a weird phenomenon at 2 years and 3 years, and it does end. It does end. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and hear from Doc Bones about something called Hantavirus. I'm sure you've heard about Hantavirus recently, and you've been, you know, they tried to scare you with it. Most of you wrote it off, and good for you, but you should know about it because it is actually a thing, especially in places like, the Four Corners area.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. You've been hearing a lot of scary stuff coming from the media about hantavirus, with some likening it to COVID or worse. Now, that's not the case, so let me clear the air a little and maybe present some clarity about the whole thing. The virus may sound familiar. The cruise ship cases, a total of maybe a dozen at present, with several dead, isn't the first time you've heard about hantavirus. There was the strange end of actor Gene Hackman and his wife last year. The 95-year-old Hackman, his 65-year-old wife, and a dog were discovered dead in their home. She was found on the bathroom floor with a spilled bottle of pills, while he was in another room. A murder-suicide? Well, nope. It turns out that she died a week before Hackman of a rare illness called Hantavirus Pulmonary Syndrome, or HPS. He died some days later of heart disease and, I would guess, dehydration. No hantavirus. The pills actually turned out to be thyroid meds. Now that was then. This time, a European couple who visited some questionable areas in Argentina were starting to feel ill when they boarded a cruise to the Antarctic. Over the next few days, a number of people got ill as well, some worse than others. So what is hantavirus? Members of the hantavirus family are mostly found in their natural reservoir. Rodents. Makes sense. Rats and mice are problems in restaurants and cruise ships, which are places where food is stored. So why talk about it on our channel? Well, rats and mice are likely to be constant companions of survival groups in disaster settings, so it's important to know about the diseases they can cause. Hantaviruses are species-specific, which means that each type of rodent has its own version of the virus. While infected rodents remain outwardly healthy, they can transmit the virus to humans and can cause life-threatening damage. Humans get infected in several ways: getting bitten or scratched by an infected animal, being in contact with droppings or urine, or eating or drinking contaminated food or water. As the medic, your next question should be, can I get sick if I take care of somebody with hantavirus? Well, there haven't been any cases of human-to-human transmission in the United States. So what went on in the cruise ship? Well, it just so happens that a South American strain of the virus can spread from person to person. That's the strain found in the cruise ship passengers. were the original culprits rats on land or on the ship? Probably on land, with others getting it on the ship from the infected passengers. So what about hantavirus pulmonary syndrome, or HPS, the deadly form of the infection? The initial symptoms of HPS are flu-like. Expect to see sudden onset of fever, cough, headache, and muscle pain. 3 to 5 days later, the infected person may feel shortness of breath and chest pain. That's different. Respiratory failure follows rapidly in these cases due to an immune reaction gone haywire. Every year in the western U.S., a few cases are reported, with about 30% being fatal. The good news, if you survive the first few days, you'll probably recover in a few weeks. Another hantavirus variant is called hemorrhagic fever with renal syndrome, or HFRS. It's been found throughout history in Asia, Africa, and Europe. During World War I, hantavirus disease was called trench nephritis, a type of kidney inflammation from rodent-infested front lines. The death rate, however, is only about 1% or so, depending on the subtype. So can you treat hantavirus infection? Well, in normal times, treatment depends on the particular variant and includes oxygen therapy, antiviral meds, and dialysis if there's kidney failure. A cure does not yet exist. Now, off the grid, it's going to be very difficult to treat a major case. The medic should alleviate symptoms like fever, ensure good hydration, and generally support the patient until they recover. Most will. It may take weeks or months to fully return to normal, though, with chronic fatigue and decreased exercise tolerance commonly seen long term. Let's talk about prevention. Now, I'm pretty wary of some vaccines, but for hantavirus, that's not an issue. There isn't one. Diligent rodent proofing is how you can help reduce the risk. Here's some steps to help. Avoid exposure to mice, rats, and their droppings. Wear gloves and a mask that covers your nose and mouth if you can't avoid exposure. Use disinfectant on areas that are contaminated. Don't use a broom to clean out droppings, as it causes viral dust to go airborne. Use a vacuum instead. Seal holes around the retreat that might allow mice and rats to enter. Set rodent traps in and around your home. Avoid leaving human or pet food outside. And assure good ventilation in the retreat. More information on rodent proofing a home can be found by using the search engine at doomandbloom.net. So is hantavirus the next worldwide pandemic? Nope. A total of less than a dozen cases on a cruise ship and a yearly few in rat-infested areas of the U.S. does not a pandemic make. Should you remain vigilant? Of course. Do your own research and come to your own conclusions. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook. And while you're at it, get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at AltonFirstAid.com. You'll be glad you did.
My only add-on there is the cruise ship itself. I think many people hear cruise ship and you're thinking like celebrity, carnival, these massive ships, you know, 16 decks. That's a 16-story building that's longer than any such building on land, right? It's like it's like taking a skyscraper that's wide enough to be 16 stories vertically and then tipping on its side and floating it on the water. You know, you have these giant, you know, amphitheaters and casinos and all these pools and water slides. And that's not the kind of cruise ship that they were on. Right. This is not your cruise to the Caribbean or to, you know, the Alaskan Inner Passage like I went on, or, you know, into the Western Caribbean or through the Panama Canal. This was a Southern Hemisphere cruise to Antarctica. There are much smaller ships with much tighter quarters. And even in that environment, it was still only a fraction of the people on the ship that got it. If you compare that to the number of cases of COVID on the ship that had COVID when the COVID thing started, it's a rounding error. Okay? So just, there you go. Anyway, moving on. Let's now, who are we going to hear from next? Jesse Markowitz on cold storage of your Bitcoin. And does Start 9 play any role in that at all if you want it to?
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz from YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Today I have a question from Betty.
Betty says, I have a Start 9 and I run a Bitcoin node. I'm looking for a cold wallet, preferably air-gapped. I presently have a Trezor. Because the Start 9 must connect to the internet, I am less inclined to use it as a substitute cold storage solution. Great question, Betty, and your instincts are exactly right. A Start 9 server running a Bitcoin node is a fantastic tool, but it is not a substitute for cold storage. Your server is designed to be online. That's the whole point. It talks to the Bitcoin network, receives blocks, validates transactions, and can serve as the private backend for your wallet software. But because it's online, it's not the right place to store your long-term private keys. The clean way to think about this is that there are three separate jobs. Your hardware wallet protects your keys and signs transactions. Your wallet software gives you the user interface. And your Start 9 node talks to the Bitcoin network and privately verifies what is happening. Since you already have a Trezor, you're in good shape. If your Trezor is set up correctly, your seed phrase is backed up securely, and you understand how to recover it, you're already ahead of most people. Knowing what you're doing and having a good process is more important than the latest technological gizmo. Trezors generally connect via a USB-C cord to the computer running the software wallet. This is not air-gapped. If you want to take the next step and replace your Trezor with a device that supports an air-gap mode, you have a number to choose from. Personally, I like ColdCard. It's Bitcoin only, has a strong reputation among serious Bitcoin users, and it supports USB connections and air-gapped workflows using micro USB cards and, with some models, QR codes. Blockstream Jade is another hardware device that supports USB, but can also be used in air-gap mode via QR codes. Foundation Passport and SeedSigner are both designed for air-gapped workflows only, no USB connections. Regardless of which you choose, make sure you buy hardware wallets from a trusted source, generally direct from the manufacturer. Hardware wallets are not magic. They protect your private keys while signing transactions, but your private keys are also recoverable from your seed phrase, so that's a critical piece as well. If your wallet is lost or damaged, your seed phrase lets you recover. But if someone else gets your seed phrase, they can take your Bitcoin. If you lose your seed phrase and the device dies, your Bitcoin may be gone forever. Nobody can help you, not Trezor, not ColdCard, not Start9, not me, not anybody. Let's come back to your Start9 server. A Bitcoin node is useful because your wallet needs some way to interact with the Bitcoin network. If you use someone else's node, that node may see the addresses you are checking, the transactions you are interested in, and the transactions you broadcast. Obviously, that is not ideal for privacy. When your wallet talks to your own node, that changes. Your wallet is not asking some random public server for your balances, it's asking your own server. You're verifying the Bitcoin network yourself, and you're reducing what you reveal to third parties. Start9 makes it easy to run your own Bitcoin node. And as long as we're talking about Start9 servers, keep in mind they can support a lot more than just a Bitcoin node. You can run password managers, tools for Nostr, communication services, your own personal cloud storage, and much, much more. So once you already have the server, it's worth exploring what else it can do for you. Bitcoin is a great use case, but it's not the only one. To sum it all up, the ideal setup is not Start9 instead of cold storage, it's Start9 plus cold storage. Betty, thank you for the question. Your thinking is sound. Keep the Start9 online doing node things. Keep the cold wallet offline doing key things. I enjoy helping people better understand how Bitcoin works so they can use it most effectively. I'm now working on a new offering, a Bitcoin risk assessment to help people understand what they have, where the weak points are, and how to better protect their Bitcoin. If you're interested in being part of my pilot program at a significantly discounted fee, please reach out. This has been Jesse Markowitz from YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Please keep sending in questions. I'm always happy to answer questions from Survival Podcast listeners.
So I got nothing. There's nothing I can add to that at all because that's everything. Anyway, let's move on. I want to talk to you about not so much the falling value of a college degree or the fact that people are waking up to it. I want to talk to you about the new spin job. And I don't know, because it's hard for me to tell as I'm monitoring my own stuff here, because I have to hear over the sound myself. If you hear some background noise in my anchor segment today, it's not in your head. It's real. I have people doing the finally doing the remodel in my office for me. It's right across the hall. It sounds like it just went away. It sounds like an air compressor, and they're probably spraying the walls with paint or primer, and that's what that sound was. So, anyway, the sound is gone. I've got the gain on the mic down. I'm taking a closer gate, and hopefully it will stay off while I complete this. Anyway, it's the spin that I want to talk about, because you're going to hear a bunch of it now, because it's not really that a college degree in of itself isn't really a great thing, and that even if you have a degree in bitterness studies, it's not better than no degree at all. We can't admit that, right? So the spin from the right, of course, the left will just say this is racism or white supremacy or disenfranchising the transgendered or somehow Israel's fault or whatever. But the right wants to come up with an excuse that they think is more plausible to you. So their excuse, of course, is blame the left. So their primary excuse is that parents don't want to send their kids to college anymore because their kids, when they go to college, are being indoctrinated with leftist dogma. Okay, first of all, half the fucking people in this country are the people that do the indoctrinating, and they want their kids indoctrinated. So 50% aren't even affected by that. About 25% of the people don't care about it, and 25% are actually opposed to it. Okay, so it doesn't have the horsepower that they're making it out to have. And again, my contention is if the underlying degree still had the value that we were told that it did and watched it decline and not have it admitted over the years, that people would, you know, still go. Number two, as I despise the term, send your kids to college. Okay, you don't send your kids to college. I mean, maybe if they're a prodigy and 14 years old, you do, but they're going on a scholarship then. You don't send kids to college. Kids don't go to fucking college. You know who goes to fucking college? Young adults. This sounds as stupid to me as when people say, well, then telling elected officials, then you send your kids off to war. You sign your kids up for the Army. You don't sign your fucking kids up for the Army or the Air Force or the Marine Corps or fucking Space Force or Potato Force or whatever else they come up for. A person enlists on their own. If they're 17 and they need your permission to do so, okay, that is the little tiny 1% in the bell curve. Most people that join the military grow up, decide they want a job, and join the fucking military. And if their parents say, I defy you to do it, you know, maybe they listen, maybe they don't, but there's nothing legally that a parent can do. You don't send your kids to college. Your kids go to college. Well, who pays the tuition? Well, in about 90% of cases, the student ends up indebted for the rest of their life on a loan that they took. Okay? So mostly, I'm going to get an email, hate mail, here it comes. Jack, I paid for my kids' tuition so that I don't care. Okay, I'm in the center of the bell curve. You're on the fucking leading edge, the bleeding edge. Most people do not send their kids to college in any way, shape, or form. Their kids apply to college. They apply for loans and grants, and then they go to school, and they go on borrowed money, and then they owe it for the rest of their lives back. So it's not that parents aren't sending their kids to college because they don't like the blue-haired professor. Great. I'm sure that's had an impact, just not enough for anybody to give a shit about. Okay, it's like the tiny little scratch on the roof of your pickup truck that's got jacked up tires that no one can see. It's there. It's really there. There was damn. No one cares. No one judges your truck, including you, about that scratch, unless you're that weird fuck that when you wax your truck, you climb up in the bed and you look, you go, oh my God, it's there. I need to do something. Okay, fine. If that's you, again, you're on the edge of the bell curve. You're not in the center where most of them are. So what's actually happening? Well, a convergence of things, which is why I could tell you this. And the other one is they don't have enough experience with AI to get a job after they get out of college. But like 57% of college students are using AI every week. That's bullshit. That's not why. Because we just covered this a couple weeks ago, didn't we? All the claims that companies are laying off workers because of AI are bullshit. I mean, they're literally all bullshit. It's complete bullshit. They are laying off workers because they overhired on easy money for 15 fucking years, and now they're right-sizing the company, and AI is an excuse. So these kids are not getting hired because, number one, college doesn't fucking prepare them for anything. That's number one in like 90% of degrees. The company still knows I'm hiring some kid that I have to train, right? You know, the degree didn't do anything. It proved that they can show up and pass a test. And now the value of that test doesn't even mean anything because they've lowered the standards so much. Freaking people with borderline retards based on IQ get into four-year schools today. That didn't happen 35, 40 years ago. Right? So they devalued the degree. This is what's really happened. And this, again, is why I was able to look at this years ago and tell you it's coming. Then another thing that happened, of course, is the enrollment cliff. There's just less people having less babies than before. So they what they did to, and this has actually been going on for a while, the number of graduates has been in decline for about 10 years. It just didn't go like off the cliff that just hit. Okay. And the way they dealt with the decline is they lowered admission standards and made money more available. So more and more percentile of graduates went. So you kind of max that out now. There's some kids that did just, even with low standards, they just can't do it. And there's some people that never will. You just, like, they, all they want, like, was, like I was as a teenager. College, high school's over? Yeah, fuck college. I'm out of here. I'm done. I don't want anything to do with this anymore. So that portion of students is a fixed number. You can't change it. So all of these things collided with each other, but the real culprit and the only real culprit is that we have had an inflationary asset have become an asset with a deflationary value. Okay? That is the only real explanation here. It costs more than ever to get a degree, existing in an economy where it costs more than ever to live. And the value of your money's going down, and the value of the appreciating asset has declined. If you walked in as somebody with a bachelor's degree in business administration, which is a reasonably decent degree, it's not super high-end, it's not STEM, right? But at least it's not communications, right? You know, basically you have a business management degree, four-year school, 1985. You go on four interviews, you're getting a fucking offer. I mean, it was really that, unless there was something really wrong with you, if you were a decent candidate, four-year degree, four interviews, at least one job offer, and a decent starting job. Maybe it wasn't the money you thought you would be making. Maybe you're not wearing, you know, at the time, like Tubbs and Crockett freaking Docker shoes and shit and riding around in a red Corvette or a Ferrari or some shit, but you could get a job and you could get a start. And it was almost a guarantee that that would happen. Maybe you had to move to a bigger place or something, you know, like a bigger city or whatever. You get a job. Now it's not even a hunting license. It's not even a hunting license anymore. The value of a business management degree or a BA or something like that, it's bullshit. It doesn't matter. A freaking MBA barely matters now. It might be a box to tick on your progression inside your firm where everything, if you're already on track, but you have an MBA today and you don't have any experience, you are freaking, you are worse than somebody with the BA. How's that? Okay, see, the MBA, this is exact, I've heard this from hiring people. They think they're worth more than they are. They have no experience, but because they have the M in front of the BA, they think they're more important. They think they're entitled to 80,000, 90,000, 100,000 out of the gate. They're not. They don't know anything. They don't really know anything as to how my company operates, what my company needs from them. There's a learning curve. I'm going to have to invest in them to make them actually able to do the job. And they will be able to do the job no better in 6 months than the person with the BA. Right? So how do you get something that people buy in mass go down in value and up in price at the same time? How does that happen? That's not just straight inflation. And I don't mean the underlying cause, like how many administrators and how many buildings they build. I mean, how do you actually make that reasonably sustainable over decades? Because this has been in play for about 30 years. Hardcore in play since about mid-90s. Like, it was already happening from about 71 up to the mid-90s, about 95. But it really started to kick into overdrive. About 95, 96, exactly 30 years ago, is when they started lowering admission standards. When my son wanted to go to college, and this is early aught, like early mid-aughts, like 07, I guess he graduated, right? I had no idea this had happened, and I look at his application, I look at the admission criteria to the school, and the lower you performed in your class rank, the lower your admission scores could be and still get in. Meaning a person that was like at a 90 percentile of their class rank had a bogey as to their admission scores that was fairly high. But if you were like in the 50th percentile of your graduating class, you could get with a much lower test score. What world does this make sense in? What world? I mean, I know it's socialism, I get, but what world does that make sense in? It makes sense in a world of institutions, even at the time, that knew that their old way of doing business was dying, but weren't ready to give it up. This is like the crack addict that says, man, I woke up in my own spit, my own shit, my own vomit again today. I ain't got no money. I just robbed 3 TV sets to buy some rock, but I'm going to quit tomorrow. I need one more time, just one more time. That's what it was. It was like an addict, one more time, slapping the vein, get the needle out. Come on, I know that vein. Okay, get the vein in my foot. But that addict went on for another 20 years. And it just got, as an addict would, got progressively worse. This is just all coming to a head. You have people that have seen the reality behind the scenes of the education. Yes, that's one piece of it. But you also have the population demographic bomb, less number of potentials going to school. You maxed out the percentage of ones you can get to do it. And of those, they are now, again, I said this 10 years ago, looking at their older siblings and going, well, they're in debt for 110 grand and they work at Starbucks. I don't want that. And then they're seeing all these other options that are available. So what does the media do? Right on cue, who has been nothing but these colleges' bitches for the last 30, 40 years. They cover for them. They're running cover fire. It's AI. It's AI. You know what they mean when they say, well, it's the blue-haired liberals or whatever? I'll tell you what they mean. What they mean is you can still find the right school for your kids, so you should do that. Now, here's the reality. What I've been preaching is becoming accepted by the mainstream, not because I said it, but because it's logical. And that is that anybody that thinks about going to college needs to fire up Excel, look at the cost of the degree path, and look at the career progression for the median in that degree path. And if the numbers don't work, don't do it. Does that mean don't go to school? It means don't go to school that way for that thing. That's what it means. And this is heresy. This is like, this is almost like, you know, you're back in biblical times and you said something against God and you're going to get stoned to death. You have the modern equivalency of stoned to death. Of course, you're not actually dead, but you're just brutalized when you say something like that. Not school sucks, don't go, but you should evaluate the career progression based on the cost of time and money that you put in. This is how you know it's a scam. Everything that you've looked at, please get the pattern recognition down, guys. Everything you've looked at in the past few decades that you were not allowed to criticize was a scam. Can I bring up COVID? Right? You could not criticize it, right? What can you not criticize right now? Israel. You can't criticize Israel. You're just a Jew-hating Nazi. I didn't say a word about Jew, right? And say anything about religion. This is a country. I have problems with almost every country in the world's foreign policy on some level. You can't tell me I'm not allowed to criticize a country. The left did it with Obama. You said anything against Obama's policies, even if you're on record for 20 years opposing that policy when other people did it, well, clearly you're a racist. Everything you're not allowed to say is protecting a scam or a fraud. Every single time. Every single time. There are no exceptions. If the public discourse has been set, if the concept has been set as a standard that you may not criticize this thing, right, then it is a scam. Well, what about legitimate things that you shouldn't be able to criticize, like, you know, protecting life or something? Do you notice that there isn't anything that prevents that? There also is not anything that prevents saying really stupid shit that's not true. They don't care because they know you look like an idiot. You're a useful idiot at that point. There's no prohibition on saying the earth is flat. There's entire YouTube channels dedicated to it. They've never had a strike. They've never been, you know, flagged for false information. Maybe if it touches global warming, then, okay. But other than that, right, you have these retards selling people this stupid story. No one does anything. An ER doctor comes out and says, not don't ventilate COVID patients, right? He simply says, we're setting the pressure too high. They shut him down. He's an ER doctor. He's worked in the ER for 20 years. He specializes in respiratory illness. And a blue-haired, nose-ring-wearing retard following a company policy by Google on YouTube shuts his channel off. But the flat earth person's allowed to say anything they want. So the extremes are fine because it's obvious they're extremes. It's when they have something they have brainwashed the bulk of society to that is logically flawed in many ways, that there's an outright ban or some sort of oppression if you speak about it. It's breaking here. It always breaks. It always breaks. And I'm gonna give you a religious quote. I know it on occasion, but not very often. And this is a Buddhist religious quote from Buddha himself. Three things cannot be long hidden: the sun, the moon, and the truth. And that's all this is. And you think, but Jack, you just said 30, 40 years of this nonsense. That is not long hidden in the timeline of human history. It is a breath. It is a mouse fart. It's like when you studied history in school and the time between 1700 and 1750 was one page in your book. It's like that. The truth has come out and more people are seeing it. More and more people are acting on it. And this is the funny thing about truth. People act on it before they speak it. And that's the real lesson here. That's the real lesson here. Here's an example that is political. Spencer Pratt is probably, and I didn't think it was possible, but I'm looking at everything now, and I think Spencer Pratt is the next mayor of Los Angeles. If you had told me, I don't care what his name was, that a Republican would be the mayor of Los Angeles and get elected in 2026, I would have said, you're smoking really, really good dope, dude. Can I get some? But it looks like it's going to happen. And here's the truth. The polls show that it's possible but not probable, but the undertow of the current shows what's really going on. How about John Cornyn getting the living shit beat out of him? And God bless Texas. You finally did it, boys. You finally stood up for yourselves, right, and got rid of this rhino piece of crap. People are like, but Paxton has problems too, and he's not good on foreign policy. He supports. I don't care. I don't care. All right? And it's not even relevant to the point I'm making. John Cornyn going away is good. I don't care who you put in there. That's a good thing. The guy's a piece of shit, and he's been around too long. And nothing makes me happier when I see any senior senator sent home, because you should have one or two terms to be gone anyway. But my bigger point is, right up till the end, this is going to be a nail biter. This is going to be close. People were, the newscasters were scheduling, you know, their time for speeches and for calling the race at 9 to 10 o'clock at night. The polls closed at 7, and the race was called about 7:20. And it was obvious by like 7:05 what was going to happen. Nobody called it, but it was obvious what was going to happen. So how do you get this disparagement, right? Don't make it political. Look at the facts on the ground and extrapolate the truth in the pattern. And the pattern is that people didn't say it, but people acted on it. So when you polled, well, that's what people say. When they went and pushed a button to vote, that's what they do. So what I'm saying about the college thing is, it is not parents and young adults speaking this right now unless they're asked, right? But what they're doing is they're taking an action, or in this case, not taking an action. They're not going. They're not applying for the loans. They're taking other pathways into the future. They're acting before they speak. The people speaking now are the mouthpieces in empty suits and empty pantsuits on the TV set who are making excuses on behalf of their masters, which control the education system, who are literally freaking the fuck out. Because how do you indoctrinate the youth if the youth won't go to the indoctrination centers? So here's what comes next. Super low-cost degrees, four-year degrees from community colleges. A refocus of advanced degrees from the mainstream universities, and a shrinking of the mainstream universities in number and campus size. And it still isn't going to work. It still isn't going to work. Because this system of education is built for 100 years ago. It still had some value 50 years ago, 40 years ago. But it was residual value. It wasn't real. It appeared real because the employment sector still valued it because it was a legacy artifact. Companies today know what it takes to be successful. And it doesn't take somebody who studied French literature. It takes somebody who comes in, understands the goal and value proposition of the company, and contributes to it. And you don't need a 4-year degree to do that. One of the other reasons I think some of these companies have not hired people without degrees is the average person with a degree is 23, 24 years old. The average person with a high school diploma is 18, 19 years of age. There's a maturity gap. And those people need something to do in those years, so go to college. That's not working anymore either. The world has changed. It's not going back. This is another Jack was right moment. This is one of those ones where, like, it is bad, but I'm still happy to be right about it. There's a lot of shit I've been right about that I'm like, I was right, and damn, I wish I wasn't. No, this I'm very happy for, because this is required for our society to grow into its next phase of existence. You were sold a lie if you're my age or a little older and even younger, right? Like 10 years either way, at least. That kind of this new world we were going into required college was actually the gateway to this glorious new world of, you know, really educated society. Well, if you take the average person that has 4 years of college, they don't have 10% of the knowledge that was conveyed to them retained. So how good is it really? People are asking questions like that and more, and they're also asking a question. In a world where a 30-year-old feels like I'll never be able to buy a house, why should they go $150,000 in debt for a degree that won't further the goal of buying the house? Because if they had that $150,000, they could probably use it as a down payment and buy a house. Or less, a lot less. So get ready to hear more. Get ready for everything to be blamed on AI while they admit at the same time that AI is not doing what they say it's doing in corporate America, and then get ready for AI to actually do what they said it was going to do later after the fact. Get ready for the boom, glut, bust. That's coming too. I told you that this week. Boom, glut, bust. Data center, data center, data center. That's because everybody wants to own the market. I built a lot of data centers in the 90s. I designed a lot of data centers in the 90s. Some of them have no data in them now. Taylor Street in Dallas, Texas. I designed a data center that under roof, not the building, the data center under roof was 3/4 of an acre, and it does nothing anymore. I designed it for Mark Cuban. It was acquired by Yahoo when they bought Broadcast.com. It died a slow death, and it doesn't do anything now. They spent $1.5 million on it in 1999, and it doesn't do anything. Boom, glut, bust. Quest has thousands of miles. They don't own it anymore. They're sold off. Thousands of miles of fiber that has never had a light go across it. Cycles repeat. It's just now happening. A lot of them are converging. We are evolving to a new level as a society. We are changing. We are in this decade of shift and flux that I forecasted. It's happening. You're living through it. The only reason it doesn't look like breakneck speed is you're in it. If you're in it, you don't see it. You can't see the box. You can't get outside of the box when you're inside the box, right? You can't see what's on the outside when you're in the inside. The top's closed. That's what's going on right now. You are in a train doing 1,000 miles an hour, but you only have a mild sense of movement because you're in the train moving with it. When people look at 2025 to 2035 or 2020 to 2040, 40 years from now, and they are 30-year-old people, they'll be like, holy shit, what was that like? Maybe some of you will still be around to tell them. Anyway, with that, we've wrapped everything up. Again, remember, I have Brad Thor coming on Monday, 26th. Bestsellers, New York Times bestsellers. So that'll be, and I've met Brad before. He's a really good guy. He's a really nice dude, and he's a really smart guy, and he's obviously a great writer. So that'll be a great interview. That'll be live on Monday at noon, and then we will have rewinds Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday next week. The following week, we've gone to 3 days now, except for, you know, like the working for Brad. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then the following week I'll be back. In the meantime, get on the list to get your copy on day one when it drops, Laws of Life, Book 2, Now Build a System for Your Life. I promise you, I give you my word, after 18 years of teaching you on this podcast, you will not regret investing in this book, and you will not regret picking up extra copies and giving them to other people. And when the second edition of Laws of Life Book 1 comes out, please pick that up too. Make that your set. You know, hold on to the original one. Maybe that'll be worth something someday as an artifact or something like that. But the book set you want on your shelf side by side is book one, second edition, and book two. Again, that's going to launch on the 30th of June, which will be 10 days after Survival Podcast turns 18 years old. Take care, guys. I'll catch you on Monday with that Brad Thor interview.
Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.